local and state board of elections and election officials not to certify the election. They refuse to do so. They follow the law. But it seems like in 2024, they're going to extraordinary lengths to try to implement the measures that failed in 2020 to try to rig the election for Trump.
And Ari, there is also intra-Republican fighting over this rule, isn't there? Could you talk about the role of Georgia Governor Kemp?
There is intra-Republican fighting, Juan, because remember, Georgia passed a sweeping voter suppression law in 2021 that made it harder to vote in a lot of different ways. One of the things that law did is it removed the Republican Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, who defended the integrity of the 2020 election and refused to find 11,780 votes, as Trump demanded, to overturn Biden's victory. That law removed Raffensperger from the state election board. So he was no longer chair or a voting member of the election board. Instead, it gave more power to the hyper gerrymandered Republican legislature to appoint a majority of board members. And so the fact that there is this Trump aligned majority on the state board of election in Georgia is a direct result of this voter suppression law that was passed by Republicans. That said, some Republicans seem to have regrets over what has occurred here. The Secretary of State Raffensperger has criticized these rule changes, saying he doesn't want 11th hour changes. Democrats have demanded an ethics inquiry. And in response to that ethics inquiry, Governor Kemp, a Republican, has asked the Attorney General of Georgia, another Republican, whether he has the power to remove the election board members. So this isn't playing well with establishment Republicans, because establishment Republicans were the ones who were purged from the state board of election in favor of this MAGA-aligned majority.
And Georgia is not the only battleground over this issue. Could you talk about what is happening in other states, specifically Michigan and Nevada?
Yeah, so we've already seen local election officials in other states, including Arizona, Michigan, Nevada, not certify local election results. We also saw that happened in Georgia, too, in the last presidential primary. And this is so concerning because these state and local election boards have been taken over in some cases by election deniers, by MAGA extremists. And what they're doing is they are trying to institutionalize the insurrection through other means. So Trump failed to overturn the election results, but in a lot of key battleground states, they didn't just change the voting laws, they also changed who's serving on these key state and local boards. And the administration of elections matters so much because you can cast a vote, you can have your vote counted, but it doesn't actually matter until votes are certified. We learned that in 2020. Nothing is final until the elections are certified. And we've already seen evidence that Republicans are preparing not to certify an election if it doesn't go their way.
Ari, you wrote a piece for Mother Jones headlined, "Tim Walz has a stellar record on voting rights." Can you talk about what that record is and how it compares, for example, with the vice presidential running mate of Trump, with J.D. Vance, who wanted to overturn the November election of 2020?
When he was governor of Minnesota, Tim Walz signed a number of really impactful bills on voting rights. He signed a Minnesota Voting Rights Act, which was meant to restore protections of the Voting Rights Act that were gutted by the Supreme Court. He passed laws making it easier to vote through things like Election Day registration, pre-registration for 16 and 17-year-olds, more early voting, restoring voting rights to 50,000 people with past felony convictions. And this is a huge contrast to the Trump's vice presidential nominee, J.D. Vance, who has basically said he would have used his power to try to overturn the 2020 election if he had been vice president, and has doubled down on election denial. So you have one vice presidential candidate in Tim Walz who has used the power of his office to try to expand voting rights, and you have another vice presidential candidate, J.D. Vance, who said he would do everything in his power to try to undermine voting rights. And that's a pretty stark contrast, particularly at a time when voting rights is emerging in Georgia and other states as a central issue in the presidential campaign.
About Arizona, Ari, what just happened there around immigrants and voting rights and the right to vote?
There was an emergency Supreme Court case that came before the Supreme Court in Arizona regarding proof of citizenship to register to vote. So having to show things like a passport or birth certificate to be able to register to vote. And the Supreme Court said that voters there have to show this documentation to be able to register to vote and to be able to vote in state elections. And this is very concerning because this is a last minute change. We're in late August right now. Arizona is a vote by mail state, so ballots get sent out soon. And there's a lot of confusion over what documents you need to register to vote. And it's thrown a lot of the state into confusion when they don't just have a competitive presidential election, but they have a competitive races for Senate, for state legislature. They have a lot of prominent ballot initiatives, including a ballot initiative on abortion. There's lots of important down ballot races over who's going to decide control of elections in places like Maricopa County, the largest county in the state. And the interesting thing is the Supreme Court has said, don't change voting laws too close to an election. Well, the Supreme Court just changed voting laws close to an election in a way that it appeared will help Republican candidates try to win the election. So it sets a very disturbing precedent, both on the ground, but for also for voting rights more broadly.
Finally, Ari, you know, we just came from the Democratic convention. Before that, the Republican convention. All the discussion of the battleground states, that these are the only ones that will determine what happens in November. Someone tweeted something like DEI for white states. Not all white states, but these are some of the these include some of the whitest and least populous states. Explain why these states are what determine who is president of the United States rather than the national popular vote. If you can explain the national popular vote interstate compact and where it stands now.
Well, the reason why we focus every year on 6 to 8 presidential battleground states is because of the Electoral College. And the Electoral College is fundamentally undemocratic in two different ways. First off, it creates a situation where you can win the Electoral College but lose the popular vote, which just violates basic notions of one person, one vote. But it's also undemocratic in that 80% of Americans have a vote that really doesn't matter for presidential elections because they live in states that are either too red or too blue to actually matter. And so the focus is always on these battleground states that tend to be whiter and more conservative and more Republican than the country as a whole. And whether you live in a redder state like Texas or a bluer state like New York or California, nobody comes to your state to campaign because you're not one of these carefully curated battlegrounds. So the Electoral College is both undemocratic and also not reflective of the country writ large. What the National Popular Vote Compact would do is if states that reach 270 Electoral College votes sign on to it, which is what you need to win the presidency, therefore they will assign their state's electors to the winner of the popular vote. So it's a way essentially to abolish the Electoral College without having to pass a constitutional amendment, which is much tougher to do.
Ari Berman, we thank you for being with us, author of Minority Rule, the right-wing attack on the will of the people and the fight to resist it. He's voting rights correspondent for Mother Jones Magazine. We'll link to your recent piece, MAGA election deniers are going all out to rig Georgia for Trump. Next up, we go to Texas, where the Republican attorney general has just led a series of raids on the homes of Latino leaders and members of LULAC, the country's oldest and largest Latino civil rights group. Stay with us.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same. And the people in the houses all went to the university where they were put in boxes and they came out all the same. And there's doctors and lawyers and business executives, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same. And they all play on the golf course and drink their martinis dry, and they all have pretty children, and the children go to school, and the children go to summer camp, And then
Little Boxes by Malvina Reynolds. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to Texas, where the Republican Attorney General Ken Paxton is raising concerns about voter suppression by targeting the country's oldest Latino civil rights group, LULAC, the League of United Latin American Citizens. LULAC was first founded to fight discrimination against citizens of Mexican descent in Texas. Now it's responding to a series of raids of the homes of LULAC member state lawmakers and other Latino leaders in the San Antonio area last week. Speaking to the media Monday, longtime LULAC volunteer, 87-year-old Lydia Martinez, described how armed officers arrived at her home at 6 a.m. with a warrant to seize electronic devices, swab for DNA as they collected evidence of alleged vote harvesting and identity fraud.
I was in my nightgown and I thought it was my next door neighbor. And I went to the door and nine officers from the attorney general's office walked in and they had a search warrant. And they told me that they were there because I had filed a complaint that seniors were not getting their mail ballots. And I said, yes, I did. And he says, do you have the names? And I said, I have a few of the names. And they came in and I said, can I get dressed? They didn't let me. They set me down and they started searching all my house, my storeroom, my garage, my kitchen, everything. And after 2 hours of questioning, they took me outside in front of all my neighbors and all the officers around me, and for half an hour while they searched the living room where I had been sitting, and after half an hour they let me go back in the house and they continued the questioning and asking me about LULAC members in particular, and I told him, why are you all doing this? And he said, because it was fraud.
LULAC is calling on the Justice Department to investigate Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton over the raids. This comes as ProPublica and the Texas Tribune report Paxton has also used consumer protection law more than a dozen times to investigate a range of mostly Latino-led organizations or groups who offer food and shelter to migrants and asylum seekers along the border. Paxton also tried to shut down the immigrant-led civil rights group FIEL in Houston, claiming it engaged in electioneering. But a judge recently shot down his effort. All of this comes as prosecutors agreed in March to drop securities fraud charges against Paxton himself that allowed him to avoid going to trial if he performed 100 hours of community service. This is separate from more recent corruption allegations Paxton faced that led to his impeachment trial last year, in which he was acquitted by the Republican-controlled Texas Senate. For more, we go to Houston, where we're joined by Cesar Espinosa, executive director of FIEL, which is the Spanish acronym for Families of Immigrants and Students in Struggle. And in Miami, Florida, we're joined by Juan Proaño, CEO of LULAC, the largest and oldest Latino civil rights group in the United States. Juan, let's begin with you. Explain what happened last week in Texas.
Well, good morning, Amy. Thank you for having me. As you said, you know, last Tuesday, to our knowledge, over 12 search warrants were actually presented to Latino leaders, LULAC members in San Antonio. In the case of Lydia, as you just described, eight armed officers came in. But in another case, Manuel Medina, almost 40 officers armed with AK-47s, SWAT gear, came in, tactical gear, came into his home at 6 a.m. His daughter was sleeping on the couch downstairs, thought somebody was breaking into the home. He was upstairs with his wife and his other daughter as they came downstairs. And they were held, interrogated for over 7 hours.
And Juan Proaño, what does this tell you about the efforts of the officials in Texas to intimidate Latino voters?
Well, I mean, you know, it's pervasive. You know, we've been obviously doing a lot of research here, And it didn't start last week. You know, this investigation on election integrity started over 2 years ago, essentially, at this point. Also referred by another Republican district attorney there with no evidence at all whatsoever. In June, we saw that they sued the Archdiocese of Rio Grande Valley, Sister Norma Pimentel, which provides migrants with services that are in this country legally. Then we saw last month with Annunciation House, which provides refugee services as well, obviously with Fiel, too. And we also saw 12 other nonprofits that effectively have gone through the same search and seizure process. At least what we've heard from the courts, that this is unconstitutional, effectively the tort law that he's using to essentially sue nonprofit organizations because they're providing, because they're 501c3 organizations and providing services to immigrants, is really blatant discrimination. You know, our expectation was that he would obviously come after LULAC and sue LULAC, but certainly we were very surprised when he started to go after Latino leaders and actual LULAC members. Of those 12 that we know of, 4 of them are LULAC members, 3 of them are women in their 80s, and they were told not to talk to anyone post the search and seizure. They took their cell phones, they took their computers, they took documentations. In the case of Lydia, they took her calendar, which is essentially where she keeps all her doctor's appointments, personal contacts, information about her prescription medicine. And she had just been to the doctor the day before and had to go back in order to get that. And so she was left without any communication device at all to communicate with her family and had to literally leave her home, go to another LULAC member's house to get assistance.
So can you talk about the timing of this, Juan Peraño? For the first time in LULAC's history, established in 1929, LULAC's Adelante PAC, the Political Action Committee, endorsed Harris and Walz, endorsed Kamala Harris to be president. Do you think that there is a direct link? And explain the different parts of your organization.
Sure. And thank you, Amy, for that question. So, you know, LULAC, to your point, was founded in 1929 in Corpus Christi. It was actually founded as a 501c4 organization. That is the entity that everyone effectively knows and commonly refers to essentially as LULAC. We have over 535 councils around the country. Every single one of those councils is incorporated. They actually carry the LULAC name and seal. We have over 240,000 members in all 50 states. And we have actually those 535 councils in 33 states and 207 cities. So we are the largest Latino membership organization in the country. In addition to that, we have a 501c3, which is our LULAC National Institute. So all of the programmatic work that we do to provide programs and services to the Latino community is actually done through our 501c3. The 501c3 is actually incorporated in the District of Columbia. And then more recently, we actually established the LULAC Adelante PAC. And so it's actually a super PAC, and actually it's incorporated in District of Columbia. You know, I don't believe that it is actually connected specifically to the PAC, primarily because all of the lawsuits and essentially the pattern of lawsuits are primarily targeting nonprofit organizations, and specifically 501c3 organizations. They also only have purview over corporations that are founded in the state of Texas. So, you know, PACSIM cannot go after the LULAC National Institute, the 501c3, or the LULAC Adelante PAC. But, you know, they obviously was very close in time. I believe the date of the endorsement was August 9th or August 10th. So less than 2 weeks ago at this point.
And Juan, I wanted to ask you about a separate matter also related to elections. On Monday, the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, announced that the state has removed over 1 million names from the Texas voter rolls. Now, purges are common in many states, but that's a big number, and it's obviously coming so close to the election.
Yeah, I mean, look, we actually saw that. It came out about 5 o'clock. You know, we started our advocacy campaign on Thursday night. It literally took us 2 days to get information about Lydia's case and to begin to gather all the facts relevant to this case. Really, it is his form of deflection, right? It's his effort to basically say, look, you know, we have 1 million people that are on our voter rolls that we effectively are removing. I actually went through those numbers. Over 467,000 of them essentially are deceased, right? Another 400,000 or so are effectively what they call in the suspended mode, but only 6,500 of those are actually what are classified effectively as non-citizens. So you're talking about 0.0065%, less than 1% of those are actually non-citizens, and only 1,900, which is 1/1,000th of a percent of that million, have actually any voting history at all whatsoever. But to say that there is systemic voter fraud and voter harvesting happening in the state of Texas is absolutely false.
Juan Peraño, in a minute, we want to ask you about LULAC's study of Project 2025. But we want to bring in Cesar Espinosa, the executive director of FIEL, Families of Immigrants and Students in the Struggle. Cesar, can you start off by talking about what happened in your new office, your old destroyed by a hurricane, about the serving of a lawsuit against you by the attorney general, who himself is under investigation and went through an impeachment trial, now is serving community service, but he's also doing this?
Well, so we unfortunately lost our office. FIEL has been here in Houston for the last 17 years. And in the 17 years, we helped out so many Houstonians, regardless of their immigration status, recover from natural disasters. So just a few days after hurricane hit, or a day after hurricane hit, I was talking to my family about the fact that I was ready to get back out there, ready to serve our community and serve people, and help people get back on their feet. Unfortunately, though, this was not the case. We were hit by two storms. Number one, the actual physical storm of Beryl. And then second, the first day we moved in to our new building, we were served with a lawsuit by the state of Texas, which really took us off guard.
And what does this lawsuit say? What have you been sued for?
This lawsuit was stating that we were electioneering by a series of social media posts who were interpreted by the Attorney General of Texas as advocating for a certain party or certain issues. But at the end of the day, our institution and our work is based on educating the community, empowering the community, and getting community members from all walks of life to be integrated fully into U.S. society.
And the lawsuit was Harris County Judge R.K. Sandil denied Paxton's efforts. Could you talk about what the judge said?
Well, at the end of the day, the Judge Sandil declared that the Attorney General Ken Paxton did not have standing in the case, that he was going too far, and at the end of the day, the case was dismissed. But this sends really alarms all over the state of Texas to many organizations who are trying to help our community, and that they could be targeted as well.
And what kind of support have you received across Texas as a result of this attack by the Attorney General?
Well, we are really overwhelmed by the amount of community support that we've received, the amount of support online, a lot of people coming forward and saying that the Attorney General has come too far. You know, I always tell my wife never to read the comments in the articles or things like that. But I myself went in and read, and what I read and what I gathered from all the articles, all the everything that was published, is the fact that people from all walks of life, from any side of the political spectrum, are feeling that this Attorney General is going way too far. And then on the heels of this, we hear about what LULAC is going through, and it's just one thing after another. Then they challenge the parole in place program. So there's so many things that they're doing, trying to disenfranchise, trying to disillusion Latinos from participating, that it's really like we are swimming up, swimming against the current here in the state of Texas.
So Juan Ferrano, as we listen to what's happened to Cesar Espinosa, and you describe the raids on your members, including the home of an 87-year-old, 35-year volunteer of LULAC, can you talk about what you're demanding of the Justice Department, a review of these Texas raids, and how Paxton's actions fit into the changing politics and demographics of Texas?
So, you know, first and foremost, we stand in solidarity with Cesar and Fiel. They are doing absolutely incredible work. And in regards to Lydia, not only is she 87 years old, Amy, she is a grandmother. She is a great-grandmother. Her five brothers actually served in the military. One of her brothers was killed in the Vietnam War and received the Silver Star. These are American U.S. citizens, right? And so, you know, for us, it really kind of sort of goes beyond the pale in regards to what these actions are. We have actually reached out to the Department of Justice. We've actually sent a letter requesting an investigation of these voter suppression tactics currently underway in Texas. We will continue to stand strong, and we're organizing our allies, both in the African-American and Latino community as well. We're going to stand, and we're going to fight.
And Juan Peraño, could you talk also about LULAC's new report, The Battle Ahead, Latino Civil Rights versus Project 2025?
Sure. And I apologize. There was one part there that I didn't answer for Amy. A little bit about the demographics. So in the last U.S. Census report put out by the Census Bureau, they reported that 12.1 million Latinos in the state of Texas for the first time. Right. And really, for some time now, Latinos actually outnumber non-Hispanic whites, which is at 12 million. OK, so when you take into account not just the Latino population in the state of Texas, but the African-American and Asian population, and even if you factored in the two races or more, the minority community in Texas now stands at over 60%. Texas is and has been a majority minority state. And so that large demographic shift that you are seeing, you know, is prevalent. And so we see these effectively as tactics for the Republicans to actually stay in control of the government in Texas. The demographics are shifting. They're not going to be able to change that anytime soon. And they are going to have to deal with that sooner than later. In regards to Project 2025, LULAC actually published a couple of weeks ago really the first and only report that I see that analyzed Project 2025 through a Latino lens. Obviously, it's been very widely reported throughout. It was obviously very prevalent in the Democratic National Convention's platform. In Chicago, we were there to listen to Vice President Harris and Wallace actually speak to that. You know, I was very concerned, shocked, when I was watching the Republican National Convention on that Tuesday, and they came out with mass deportation signs. You know, somebody thought about that. Somebody designed those signs. They ordered them. They printed them. They passed them out to thousands of people in that convention center. That's only one part of what is in Project 2025. You know, they're talking about effectively, you know, programs which effectively are for unserved communities of gutting that. The Department of Education as well, limiting different types of visas which allow for pathways for citizenship into this country. It is systemic all the way through. It would impact not only Latino communities, but other immigrant and minority communities across the country. And not just minority communities. It would impact a significant number of non-Hispanic whites because it really cuts across socioeconomic factors as well.
We want to thank you both so much for being with us. Juan Peraño is CEO of LULAC. He was speaking to us from Miami, Florida. And Cesar Espinosa is executive director of FIEL in Houston, Families of Immigrants and Students in the Struggle. You can see all of our segments on the Republican and Democratic National Conventions and Immigration and Project 2025 at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Radio Rewind.